All right, I'm Rick Hansen. It's March 22nd, 2017. And last week, if you were here, we started talking about mindfulness having to do with relationships, in particularly mindfulness having to do with the fact that other people have people in their lives who eventually pass away or change, leave home, things happen. And that's a reality ourselves. So how do we begin to come to terms with that fact of biological, animal, embodied existence? Leaves, bud, you know, develop, and then fall. So that's what last week was about, and not in a grim or morbid sense, but more from the within a Buddhist framework of how do we come to terms with and see clearly what is actually true, and find a way to be peaceful, fundamentally inside about it. That leads into the larger topic of impermanence, which is a central subject, in some ways the central subject in Buddhist psychology and practice, and I'd like to explore that with you tonight. So I'll offer some notions. The more that these ideas and words of mine are experiential, and brought into the present moment of your own awareness, the more real and concrete it will become. So the Buddha observed that impermanence is a fact and that a deepening awareness of impermanence is really, really useful. It is the case that in the early centuries of Buddhism, the defining characteristic, it was kind of a short phrase, that identified people who were interested in Buddhist practice and perhaps identified themselves as followers of the Buddha, identified themselves as one who recognizes the impermanence of all experiences. That's a defining hallmark, very central. So with regard to impermanence, there is the impermanence of most material things. Things change. Many people have observed that. It's springtime, at least in this corner of the world. Flowers are blooming in my backyard. Buds are sprouting. The birds are really excited, hooking up with each other, out of my gaze, of course. But who knows what they're doing up in those trees? The squirrels are hopping along. It's like, oh. So good things are happening, emerging, you know, things appearing. Also, of course, in the physical world, things change in other ways. We inhale and then we exhale. Our rust never sleeps. Food in the refrigerator gets moldy. It changes. The garbage needs to be taken out. The hours go by. The moon changes. The sun rises and sets. The earth goes around the sun. And those material changes are very real. The Buddha himself was a kind of gentleman farmer. He was landed gentry 25 or so hundred years ago in an agrarian, kind of sort of feudal society. And many, many metaphors that he uses have to do with farming. Nutriment, fertilizer, what you nourish grows, for better or worse, those kind of metaphors. Also, at the time, the ritual of fire was very central. And there are many other metaphors about fire and burning and the fuel that keeps driving the fire. And if you withdraw the fuel, the fire goes out. The fundamental root of the word nirvana, or that's Sanskrit, in Pali, the language of the early Buddhist discourses, nibbana, same word, just slightly different pronunciation. The root of that word is cooling or quenching or extinguishing. And people informally would use the term, in effect, I nibbana'd the rice, I removed it from the fire. You see there this focus on changes, because what changes more, really, than a flickering flame? But the Buddha was not interested in the material universe per se. He acknowledged its existence. He didn't deny its reality. He really was grounded in the very immediate realities. I think of my father, who grew up on a ranch in North Dakota, born in late November 1918. The agrarian farming life really puts you up close and personal with a lot of changing, everyday, very concrete realities. And you need to get your arms around those very concrete realities, or you don't have any food in the wintertime, for example. But the Buddha was most fundamentally interested in our experience, our phenomenology, our consciousness. And so when he uses words like the world or the world is burning, he's really talking about the constructed world, the construction, the creation of perceptions of a presumably existent object or reality inside our own mind. And so in terms of that, if we now bring it into the immediacy of our experience, while it's very clear that some things, quote unquote, out there in material reality are not impermanent. For example, that which is past will always have been past. It did happen. It will never not have happened that way. Unfortunately, the Golden State Warriors will never have won last year's championship. That is permanently the case. It's, as best we know, permanently the case that the area of a circle in a plane is pi times the radius squared. That is the case. The certain fundamental physical constants of the universe seem to be permanently that way. But certainly inside the mind, there's constant flux, constant dynamism, constant effervescence, bubbling, brewing, stewing, and changing. And we can see that very directly. We can see that what you're experiencing right now is not what you were experiencing a second ago, second after second after second. You, even when we're fairly stable and still, there's an ongoing sort of fizziness in consciousness, a kind of dynamism to it, kind of bubbling quality to it, even if things are quite quiet inside. A friend of mine lost his son to cancer when his son was just 19 years old, and my friend now is in his early 70s, and every time he thinks about his son, he feels just as horrible. That doesn't really change, for him at least. And it's also true, though, that some of the qualities of that horribleness evolve. Some of the contextualizing of it changes over time. And other things that are present in his mind have evolved and developed, many in good ways, over the years. So there's a dynamic process of change there. In terms of, just to give a little sense of it, the underlying neuropsychology, as best we can tell, the probably necessary, if not complete, basis for our experience moment to moment of hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, remembering, imagining, emoting, longing, etc. The underlying neural substrates of that, and when I hedged my statement about complete, maybe some sort of transcendental X factor also needs to be in the mix for a full causal account of consciousness. But minimally, it's pretty clear, certainly within the natural frame, no brain, no mind, right? So what's going on in there? And you may know this information already. If not, and every time I hear it anew or think about it anew, it's quite extraordinary to me. You know, when right inside your head right now are roughly 1.1 trillion cells, all microscopic, 10% or so are neurons, 100 billion or so, as many as there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. And on average, neurons make several thousand connections with other neurons, synapses. So now we've got several hundred trillion little microprocessors inside the head, little synapses. And now if you can kind of scale it down, neurons, as you probably have seen them, they have kind of a fat cell body with lots of wires sticking out. There are multiple types of neurons, but that's kind of the basic idea. The average cell body is pretty fat. You could put five of them side by side, on average, more or less, in the width of a single hair. So just think about that, a fifth of a hair. It's roughly the size of a cell body of a neuron. And then these little gaps, several hundred trillion of which, are sparkling away as you're listening to me now. You could put 5,000 of those little synaptic gaps in the width of a single human hair. A typical neuron is firing 5 to 50 times a second. Large coalitions of millions, probably often billions, of synapses in synchronized firing are firing 5, 10, 50, 80, even up to 100 times per second in harmony with each other. In the process of that, they're releasing little tiny bubbles of molecules, neuromodulators, neurotransmitters, neurochemicals. They're taking up the downstream receiving synapse, sort of like a docking site, a little ship, you know, docks, offloads its cargo. That cargo creates a kind of domino chain of events, often tipping down into the nucleus of the neuron that's received the cargo, in a very rapid pace, triggering more cellular changes. Events happening literally hundreds of times a second involving cells, sometimes thousands of times a second, or in thousandths of a second, rather. All happening dynamically. Synapses, these little docking sites, are continually undergoing processes of repair, ending and then rebuilding. The life of a typical synapse, many neurons, is around 2 weeks. It's continually being changed over. Electrochemical processes are sparkling away, literally, in certain senses, at the speed of light. It's all happening really, really quickly. And that underlying dynamism and instability and complexity is the physical basis of our experience and consciousness of a fizzing, changing, dynamic, unstable experience, fundamentally. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? To kind of... People often talk about mindfulness of the body, but we are actually body full of mind. And often people don't really take into account the ways in which the body, shaped by 3.5 billion years of life, 650 million or so years of multi-celled creatures, that the body itself is the underlying basis that is continually constraining and conditioning and constructing our everyday experiences as we go through our life, including the experiences we're having while we're asleep. So what's the use of recognizing all this? What's the use? Why did the Buddha emphasize so much deep, embodied, in stable insight into transience? Why? What's useful about it? Well, one thing that's useful about it is that it undermines the chase. Because when we start realizing that the apples we reach for are going to change over time, that pleasures will pass away, either because we consume them or because we'll grow numb to them or habituate to them, or otherwise they will pass away. Our own righteousness, our own attachment to view or positions about this or that, that will change over time. New information will emerge. We'll move on to other things. Getting attached to our case about other people, that too will evolve over time. Our status, our accomplishments, our position, it too will pass. Your book will no longer be in the top 100 on Amazon. Who knew? That incredible hit that some rock and roll band had 10 years ago, no one can remember anymore. It will pass away. Beauty fades, as it were, of various kinds. So when you know that, when you get that for example, these anticipated pleasures that we sort of organize the mind around, like how great it will be to go shopping and finally get that super special thing, or how great it will be to finally make that point to that person who seems impervious to your wisdom. Not that I'd ever know what that's about. The idea, you know, that, okay, I'm going to have so much fun if I just eat that cookie or, you know, drink that wine or something. When you finally, or have that sex, if you finally get to it, it's good, it's nice, but it's rarely as great as was sort of advertised in the inner simulator, you know, the inner movie maker of the mind. So it helps create disenchantment, healthy disenchantment. That's a term that's really valued in Buddhism, where we wake up from the enchantment, the spell of chasing pleasures. We're left with appropriate ambition, appropriate passion, appropriate pursuit, but we're not so gripped by it. We're not so tense about it, and therefore we suffer less because we recognize that it will pass away. It'll be replaced by something else. A second way that the recognition of impermanence is really useful is it helps us appreciate that pains pass away too, or joys may possibly grow alongside them. Even for my friend, that pain itself never goes away. Other pleasures can arise. He now has grandchildren, he has two daughters, he has friends, he enjoys what he does, he has new chances to read, to live, and to celebrate his son's beautiful and too short life along the way. So it helps us understand that the grief we feel, or the anger we feel, or the shock we feel will probably fade. It helps us appreciate that the horrible condition we're dealing with, or that other people are dealing with, is certainly unjust, and it too will be part of the ongoing changing processes in a universe that's 13.7 or so, maybe even 13.8 billion years old. Think of the number of times the Earth has gone around the sun in the last 4.5 billion or so years. Think of the number of generations that have lived on this Earth, have walked this Earth since our ancestors began using tools to make tools about 2.5 million years ago. So it doesn't make it any less. I got to visit the Mediterranean last spring, and I was in Crete and some Greek islands and Greece itself. It was quite an extraordinary experience. And you'd be kind of, you'd like do a little tour around Crete, say, and your driver would stop and say, here, you know, this is an important site. You go walking out in what feels like just an empty field, and you start realizing that there are walls on the ground there that are made of stone very skillfully, a foot or so wide, that mark the outlines of a house that some wealthy family had 3,000 or so years ago. And you just imagine the sound of children playing, laughing, people crying, voices raised in anger, time, you know, changing, a lot of blood spilled on, you know, that ground over many thousands of years. And still here I am today, walking around on a beautiful spring day. It's peaceful, civil society in that corner of the world changes. So it gives us a sense of perspective that helps us hold our pains and sorrows more lightly and be less afflicted by them. Be more able to have them, as the Buddha put it, not penetrate the mind and remain. Because we understand they're transients. They're impermanence. And then there's probably a third benefit of the recognition of transience and impermanence, which is that as one becomes more and more close to the front edge of now and steps out of the well-intended inner simulator that has recursive loops of feedback in the brain that kind of keeps it sort of like it means that the subject of now for most people is about a second and a half long. Well, that's a lot of neural activity in a second and a half. So it kind of seems like there's a stability of the now that is a well-intended way to sort of help us manage life and, you know, dodge saber-toothed tigers and get enough bananas. But it deludes us to not recognize that now, temporally, is infinitely thin or narrow, and that what was existent, as best we can tell, you know, a thousandth of a billionth, et cetera, of a second ago, is no longer real. It's gone. Just like that. Wow. And the deepening recognition of impermanence, supported by growing steadiness of mind, stability of present moment mindfulness, and growing granularity of mindfulness, where we really recognize little changes and rapid changes, and also rapid changes in really small aspects, tiny little details of the mind continuously. That starts bringing you closer and closer into that razor-thin immediacy of present moment experience. For me, it's a little bit like sitting at the edge of a waterfall of time, of reality, of experience, continuously rushing by. And we, by our nature, try to hold on to the waterfall of experience roaring by, but we can't hold on to it because it's gone. And as soon as, even as we try to reach for something or hold on to it, it's too late. And that reaching has tension in it, has craving and suffering in it, often a lot of selfing, a sense of me wanting to hold on and have it be a certain way. And we just can't do it. It's not successful. It's doomed. It's futile. It's we're designed to try, and we're going to fail every single time. And that's a primary engine of our suffering that then drives a lot of other suffering as we try to anesthetize ourselves or escape somehow, or find, you know, proofs of stability in an endless changing world, because in some fundamental existential sense, we get it, that the ground is continually opening out beneath our feet. Happily, the ground is endlessly renewed. But in the beginning, you're kind of shocked at the roaring disappearance of the present moment. So to help oneself become more and more comfortable at that front edge of now, it helps to shore up one's awareness of arisingness, of the reassuring for the scared little monkey of the body, the reassuringness of the ongoingness of allness, and until the very end, the ongoingness of personal existence, personal consciousness. That said, as we get closer and closer to the front edge of now, more and more in the immediacy, including in real time, not just in deeper states of meditative contemplation, but in real time, we get more and more comfortable with the disappearingness of our experience, we more radically and utterly give up craving, give up the chasing, the holding that's futile. And we become more relaxed about simply being amidst groundlessness as we put our children to bed, write an email, make coffee in the morning, and watch Rachel Maddow at night, or something else you do. So, and that's really quite radical and profound as a deep way to undo suffering, which is the Buddha's fundamental quest, and replace suffering with, as he put it, that greatest happiness, peace. And to finish, I can say from my own experience, and I really believe that this is a report of many of my teachers and also people in history who've gone a far distance, if not all the way. And this was the Buddha's own very firm teaching that remarkably, radically, as we become more and more given over to and accepting of the fact of impermanence, that we start to, in a funny way, begin to have a sense of the stability of ongoingness. And the Buddha emphasized this notion of conditionality, that anything that is subject to arising is subject to passing away, causes and effects. And what happens in his experience, and in the experience of, I think, many, many other people, and we can ourselves have intimations of this before Nibbana, full awakening, that as one comes more and more into the front edge of conditionality, impermanent conditionality, particularly of one's own experience, that there could be a growing intimation of what is unconditioned. As he put it, the deathless, that which is not subject to arising and passing away, that which is by definition permanent in some sense, deathless, eternal, transcendental, in some meaningful sense, distinct from the conditioned and therefore endlessly impermanent natural realm of materiality, material reality. That's quite an opportunity, isn't it? And to finish, it speaks to the different ways in which one can engage Buddhist practice, and it's fine. It's to find one's own way. But it was very clear to the Buddha that his enterprise was, in the fancy language of philosophy I've learned, soteriological or salvatory. It was about personal salvation in some sense, not in the Hindu Jain sense of his time 2,500 years ago, or in a sense that in a kind of Judeo-Christian, Abrahamic, which includes Islam, kind of frame of much Western religion, but in a fundamental transformative sense that the ultimate aim of practice is to essentially abide freely at the front edge of emergent now with some ongoing intimation of unconditionality, out of which conditioned reality, including our experience, arises and passes away endlessly. And that's a profound, ultimate matter. It's not to be speechified about. Ultimately, it's about being experienced, not theologized about or theorized about. And it's available to us, the closer we get to the front edge of now, to have a growing kind of intuition or intimation of that which is always just prior to the conditioned emergence of the front edge of now as it passes away. The word for impermanence in Pali, which is the word I'll end on here and see what you make of all this, is anicca. Okay. When you make of all this, what would you like to say? Please.
I was wondering if you think that our drive to reify the temporal world as eternal could derive from a more of an intuitive sense of our true nature, which is not subject to change, is more eternal.
Yeah.
That, and we're making a shift, sort of the same way, we have our real false self and real self in psychology that exists in different dimensions, and that would be another higher dimension of that.
I think you're making a really profound point. And as I hear you say it, we have an intuition of eternity, if you will, something, and then we take that intuition and we turn it into a thing. And as soon as we turn it into a thing, we're in trouble. And then we also often locate it out there, rather than recognizing that, and again, it transcends language to even speak about it. But that it's always already here, so, like that. Yeah, that's quite something you're saying. Yeah, Tom.
I've had some experiences, I'm sure everybody has, where you're in a social setting, one other person, I was at a dinner party once where it happened, where somebody hijacks now, and it's very upsetting.
Can you say what you mean? Yeah, you are. You're okay.
I was at a dinner party a couple years ago, and the hostess raised the topic of, hey, everybody, what was it like when you were 26? You know, we're all several decades past 26. And it annoyed the hell out of me as a topic to dwell upon. I mean, I wanted to say, well, what's happening today,
uh-huh.
you know, right now?
Yeah.
And, but it was, maybe it's because of this teaching of the awareness of now.
Mm. Yeah. Well, thank you.
Yeah, very upsetting. I guess I need to deal with that.
Well, but I think you're also getting something where people can get in and out. Like, you know, in the present moment, we can reflect on the past. In the present moment,
sure.
you know, we can imagine a future. And
yeah.
The trick is not getting lost in the simulator, in all the inner mini movies.
Yeah. Like,
that's what you're getting at, I think.
Yeah. Well, it was like the whole evening subject.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, I find that it really helps to kind of bring it down into practice. You know, staying in the present moment, just now, and there can be a real interesting, just as practice, recognition a handful of times every day of passing awayness. You know, that right now, like what right now is different than 2 seconds ago or 20 seconds ago now. Or you're watching television and what you're watching is different from what was there a few minutes before or hours before. Or you move through your day and you realize as I go through my day, this is not then, now is not then. And it helps to really kind of bring it home and to help oneself become more and more comfortable with it. Then that's grounded practice in real life. And that's what the Buddha was really focused on. Comments, questions, please.
For some reason, this just came to mind. I think it's from A Course in Miracles, but I can't really remember.
Yeah. Ah.
So the more we're in the past, ruminating, or in the future, planning, we're like missing opportunities for miracles, because the potential for miracle is where the spiritual meets the mundane, let's say.
Yeah.
Which is only in this moment. In the future.
Yeah. Yeah. I thank you for that. I'm struck by my own neurotic process. When something has caught me, right, of one kind or another, a kind of enabling factor or condition of getting irritated or plugged in or anxious about something is there's this sort of presumption of the permanence somehow, you know, the endlessness of whatever's bugging me or worrying me or feeling hurting me, something like that. And isn't it's kind of cool to actually try to step out of that enchantment, the enchantment of permanence, disenchantment, step out of that enchantment in real time and go, and kind of step back from it, especially when you start to notice that it's present and ask yourself, you know, is it always going to be like this? Is it always going to only be like this? Maybe if it's always going to be like this, all right, but other things are also going to emerge and change and become true. Right? To locate even the thing that we're glommed onto, like a fly, you know, stuck to, you know, amber, to recognize and locate this thing is probably not something that's really going to bother me 10 days from now or 10 hours from now, certainly not 10 years from now. Right? Definitely this is not going to be what I'm preoccupied with on my deathbed, at least if I've been doing any kind of real practice. So anyway, that can be useful too. Any other comments or examples? Yeah.
I'm just trying to see if I understood this correctly. What I think you're saying is that if you get in touch with how the now is constantly changing, that you start getting feeling of things that are permanent, but I don't quite understand what the arising is.
Okay, that's great. It really helps to bring it down to experience. Okay, so, you know, and you just sort of, it helps to be a little quieter in the mind so there's some stability of the witnessing. Okay, so you establish a certain steadiness of mind in meditation or just doing like a little experiment, just even for a minute. Why don't we do it for roughly a couple dozen seconds, a breath or two or three? And my suggestion is, in the sensations, notice as how the sensations of this moment are no longer existent continuously, right? They continuously pass away. They're not here anymore. Literally, as you're aware over a handful of seconds of an inhalation, sensations that were here a second ago aren't here anymore exactly, okay? And also, though, you know, as and it can help to start with focusing initially on the leaving, the endings, the passing aways. But then shift over to, oh, really interesting. One thing after another is arising. Just like one thing after another is leaving, one thing after another is coming. So let's try that as a little experiment quietly for about 30 seconds. I'll do it with you. Focusing on sensations of breathing, but obviously lots of other stuff's happening in the mind as well that you can apply the same awareness to. Okay. So you can go, what did we observe directly, just in the interest of time, because the other part of your question, the deep end of the pool is where I'm going. I don't want to finish by 8:30 or so. Probably we all observed that it's of the nature of experience to be continuously going. Whatever we're experiencing right this second or instant is going. It's leaving. It's not here anymore. But it's also true that one thing after another is happening, one thing after another in experience. Certainly as long as you've got an alive body with metabolic activity in the brain, even for the last few minutes after the final breath and beat of the heart, there's still metabolic activity in the brain as the lights slowly go out. As that is happening, one formation after another, one eddy in the stream of consciousness after another is coalescing into being. Right? You could, correct? We can see that quite directly in our experience. So, and what the Buddha encouraged, and see for yourself, is that it's really useful to develop that understanding kind of conceptually, and especially useful to be able to have more real-time consciousness of this feature, of the nature of experience flowing along. Okay. And to my point that as we become a little more comfortable with this process, we become less attached to what's happening in this instant. It's a little bit like consciousness is a standing wave, in a sense, like in a stream, the river's flowing over a boulder, there's a standing wave. The wave has a certain stability to it. There's that particular boulder, that particular wave, your standing wave, my standing wave, some continuity over the lifespan of this particular body. And yet you can look closely and see that the standing wave itself, if you had a movie and you could slow it down, slow motion, it's continually changing. Drops are flying in different directions, you know, rising and falling. It's affected by the rain in the mountains yesterday that's finally coming through, things like that. And that then we become less attached to what's actually happening at the apex of this instant of the standing wave of consciousness. we cling to it less, we crave it less. We become more at peace with the realities of endless changing. Okay? Okay? That's great, right there. That's solid, that's gold, that's useful, that's obvious in our experience. There's no woo-woo, right? It's science, Mr. Wizard says, you know. It's real news, you know, that fact and feature of our experience. People describe it, we observe it in ourselves, it's great. Then, deep end of the pool, and it's a sea for oneself. The Buddhist described in his own experience and this repeated description in the main path he taught, and there are other paths to this same result, in which the mind, and therefore the brain, gets quieter and quieter through non-ordinary states of meditative consciousness. It's not the only pathway to nirvana, but it's a primary pathway. And then at some point in that process, one goes through what he called cessation, the end of the four formless jhanas after the four form jhanas, so-called, da-da. And at that point, boom, there's an intimation of unconditionality. The unconditioned, the deathless, that which is outside the frame of conditioned phenomena arising and passing away, he said. And so he's making, first of all, an ontological statement about what is reality. He's saying, yes, there really is an unconditionality. Call it whatever you want, the transcendental, the divine, God, the mystery, the ground, the nameless. There is an unconditionality or unconditioned that is some meaningfully way distinct from this world of passing wonders and horrors, and is therefore a reliable basis for lasting, durable happiness. That was his fundamental interest at the highest reaches of human potential. We see for ourselves what's important to us. For me, it's personally important to get as far along as I can in this life in that process. Along the way, if it is actually the case that there is unconditionality, that what's, for me, outside the Buddhist tradition, the seemingly happiest, wisest, most virtuous, most extraordinary, uncommon, and yet still many in all kinds of traditions and outside of any particular spiritual or religious tradition, individuals report, they too say, yep, can't talk about it, since whatever you say about it is inside conditioned reality, but yep. Multiple fingers pointing at one moon, as it were, in the metaphor that's used. So then the question is, can we have a sense of that? I don't know about you, I'm not like, yeah, does that sound cool? Right? Much better than the best chocolate chip cookie we've ever had, to have some intimation of the eternal, you know, the divine. You're like, yeah. And again, I'm not offering this as a pitch. I am naming that this is fundamental Buddhist teaching, certainly as the Buddha, as best we know, thought and taught and offered. So to finish, right here and right now, it's my observation in my own experience and as a way to kind of get to the heart of what so many saints and sages report, that as they, as you said, come right into the moment. For me, it's a meaningful term, the emergent edge of now, or the front edge of now, even as it disappears into groundlessness. That as we come right into that edge, we start having some intimation, as the way I put it, of what's always just prior to it. You know, time is passing through us, or we are passing through time. What's always just prior, eternally so. And what I've observed is that as people get closer and closer to that front edge, they have a kind of intimation of something extraordinary. As soon as you conceptualize the extraordinary, bingo, you're in time again. It's time and timelessness. But there's this sort of intimation or sense or intuition of timelessness. And then you think about it, you know, now the idea is in time and the desire to get back into timelessness, where did it go, is in time. So the funny little trick is to be sort of peaceful at the rushing front edge of now while abiding almost kind of in the way I feel it is a little bit like this, front and back, abiding in a fundamental, ongoing awareness of freedom that's always existent just prior to conditioned unfreedom, which then is gone till the next conditioned, congealed actuality appears continuously. And that's an exploration. Okay? Got it, right? Yeah. No big, just eternity. Now. All right, let's sit for a minute and keep changing. If what the Buddha was talking about and what I have been talking about or trying to, what great saints and sages have pointed to, if it is true, by its nature, it's always already true. And we can, in a sense, fall back into it continuously. It's good news. It's the nature of things and us already. Thank you for being here now.